You're listening to an American Free Press podcast. Hello and welcome. Nearly every American who receives mail is aware of the decennial event known as the U.S. Census, but very few know of another census that took place at the same time this year. This census, however, was not concerned with counting human heads, but heads of bees, specifically honeybees. While the U.S. human population is expected to grow by about 10%, the U.S. honeybee population is expected to fall by about 50%. Something known as colony collapse disorder, or CCD, is a phenomenon in which the worker bees abandon the hive and mysteriously die off. Although the exact cause of CCD is unknown, the attrition is dramatic enough that the nation's beekeepers and scientists are now in a desperate search for answers. A recently released research article titled "High Levels of Miticides and Agrochemicals in North American Apiaries, Implications for Honeybee Health," added to the panic. I spoke with three honeybee experts to find out what all this means for you, me, the bees, and the fruits, no pun intended, of their labor. I'm joined today on the phone by Dr. Jeff Pettis of the Department of Agriculture's Bee Research Laboratory in Beltsville, Maryland. Is that right, Dr. Pettis?
Correct. Well, I'm basically an entomologist, so I study insects, but I've done almost exclusively research on honeybees since I started in my bachelor's in science. So I've pretty much been working with honeybees all my scientific career. And I'm the research leader here at the Agricultural Research Service, which is part of the USDA in Beltsville, Maryland. And our lab works on bee health, trying to combat bacterial and viral disorders and parasitic mites and things like that.
Gotcha. An AP piece that came over the wire recently that was titled "Bees in More Trouble Than Ever After Bad Winter." Did the winter have anything to do with that, or is that title just wrong?
Well, first of all, it gets a little ahead of the story. We believe it's going to be one of the worst lost years yet, but we won't have those actual figures until the end of April. So we're polling beekeepers as we speak. We have a survey out. We've gotten about 2,000 responses back, and we haven't started tabulating those. But anecdotal evidence is that this is going to be a particularly bad winter for bee survival. Certainly there is a part of that that is weather-related. In other words, a really bad winter. Actually, it can be too cold and or too hot. If it's too hot, the bees actually use more energy. They start burning through their honey supplies and can actually use more honey if it warms up periodically rather than staying cool through the winter. So it's weather can certainly play a role in it.
But that's not the main.
No, the winter losses due to weather should be consistent year after year, or fairly consistent. And what we're seeing is we've been suffering about a 30% loss over the past 4 to 6 years, and those numbers are above what we would expect. They're probably some combination of this colony collapse disorder that we've described over the past 4 or 5 years, and maybe some other factors just coming together. So bee health is really in poor shape currently.
Gotcha. So you actually conduct a survey. It's going to be completed, you said, at the end of this month?
Yeah.
You said you have so far received responses from 2,000. It's kind of like a mini census, I guess. So you received from 2,000. How many more to go?
Well, who knows? I mean, we'll see how many we get. Last year, we surveyed beekeepers who managed almost 20% of our nation's colonies. So the beekeepers that we surveyed represented about 20% of the 2.5 million colonies that we estimate that we have. So this year, the response has been even greater as far as early initial response to our survey. So I think we'll get even a broader representation. The more you get in the survey, the more reliable your numbers are. So we're kind of looking forward to seeing what the numbers say this year.
Right. And you're a beekeeper yourself.
I'm a beekeeper as well.
Right.
Well, what we do is the beekeeper knows what he or she started the late fall and winter with. They put a certain number of colonies into winter. Let's say it was 100 colonies. That would be, a large sideliner beekeeper, but 100 colonies. and they start checking in February, March, or April, how many made it through the winter?
How many bees are in a colony?
Somewhere low end 20,000, high end 40,000 to 60,000.
Okay.
So a lot of bees.
Yeah. Right.
If you do the math. But in any case, the beekeeper will go out and say, well, I suffered 20% or I lost 40% of my colonies through the fall and winter.
Right.
They also can look in there and look, are there dead bees present in the hive? They all fell down and died in the hive. Did they run out of honey? They can make some determination of why they think the colonies died. And so we ask some questions related to that, some signs and symptoms of why they believe those colonies died. And that helps us to, obviously it's online or phone survey. So we don't actually see these colonies.
Right.
We do some of that. We do some actually ground truth, and we go out and actually examine some colonies, normally in California and a few other places. But the survey is done. We're relying on the beekeepers to give us accurate information.
Right. And there's really no reason for them to give you inaccurate information.
No, I mean, right. And some beekeepers, you know, they're very proud of the fact that maybe they only suffered 5% loss or 10% loss, but we do know commercial beekeepers this past winter that suffered 60% and greater losses of their colonies. So.
Are pesticides the main culprit in all this, Doctor?
Well, that's one of the things that we know is not helping bees. I wouldn't say that is a cause. I would say that it's a contributing factor. There's quite a difference there. We have seen, and we've recently published on the variety of chemicals that are coming in through the pollen that the bees bring into the hive, and it's troubling, but we don't have any direct evidence that it's just pesticides acting alone. We've seen pathogens, some of the viruses and other things increase in colonies when they're exposed to pesticides. So it could be some synergistic effect of several things coming together. And so we're trying to understand the role that each of these play. And certainly things like pesticides don't help, nor do things like poor nutrition. So
over the past 10 to 15 years, as you said, there's newer chemicals that have been more broadly used and called systemics.
Systemics. There's a group of systemic pesticides, which we haven't had in the past, that move internally in the plant, and by being inside the plant, if the pest insect feeds on the plant, then that acts to kill the insect. But if it gets moved out into pollen or nectar produced by the plant, then bees or other pollinators might be exposed to that. And that's where the concern is, that we do have these newer chemistries that move systemically in the plant, and they could be problematic. I mean, we're concerned. In the 40s and 50s, if bees encountered certain classes of pesticides, they died in the field or they died in the hive as soon as they got back, and it was very obvious that they'd suffered a pesticide kill. In some cases, we believe that there's some exposure that's going on that's sublethal in nature, and so the effects aren't as dramatic, but they still may be contributing to the problems that we're seeing in bee health.
Right, and of course, the EPA has spent most of their time doing lethal testing and not sublethal.
Yes, most of the testing in previous years has been using what we call LD50 values. What amount of a product does it take to kill 50% of a population of insects? And things are regulated on that manner. And EPA is well aware that it would be nice to have some additional testing when there's cause for concern with a certain chemical or class of chemicals, that perhaps a slightly different test would be appropriate. And they're working on those protocols now.
Right. And you said LD50. I guess that stands for lethal dose.
Sorry, lethal dose 50. Yes.
Gotcha. Yeah. Approximately one-third of our diet comes from bees, indirectly.
Exactly. That's why people should be concerned, because, I mean, you know, you could. We need honeybees in particular for modern agriculture, for large-scale agriculture, but we need pollinators in general for a diverse diet. So.
And what's the worst that could happen?
Worst that could happen, I mean, if we really lost, you know, especially honeybees or most of the pollinators, we'd lose the fruits and vegetables, by and large, in our diet. When pollinated crops, corn, rice, wheat, things like that, make up about two-thirds of our diet. That's all the staples.
Okay. But
if you really had to put a worst case scenario in it,
right,
without pollination, you'd lose apples, nuts and cherries, and a lot of the fruits and vegetables, the melons and squash and cucumbers, all those things have to be pollinated by something moving pollen between the plants, usually a bee of some sort. Yeah.
And what are the odds of that happening, you think?
I think that's pretty low, but still, there's still cause for concern that we're not turning the tide yet. So, yeah.
It could unravel quickly, you think?
I'm usually more optimistic than that, so I'm not going to go there. I'm not going
to
quite.
Does optimism have really much to do with it, or is it just science?
Well, again, that's why we do these poll numbers. We'll know it by the end of April how many colonies we lost this year. Okay. But we've been averaging 30% or greater losses every year for the past 3 years. And it's been our fourth year.
And it's never been like that.
And it has not been this high in the past.
But you've never been keeping track of it.
No, but I mean, I'm a beekeeper as well. And most beekeepers will tell you they used to suffer about 10% loss. You know, so, I mean, the 30% is high and it's unsustainable. Yeah.
Well, thanks so much for your time, Dr. Pettis. I appreciate it.
All right. Thank you.
Take care.
Bye.
I spoke with Marianne Fraser, Senior Honeybee Extension Specialist at Penn State University, and one of the authors of this study.
That's one of the things that our paper found, was that not only, you know, are the bees exposed, and we think that the bees can handle a certain amount of exposure to pesticides and deal with it, but we are concerned about the amount and kinds of pesticides we found, you know, on average six
right.
pesticides in a pollen sample, and over 31 is our high, 31 different pesticides, and so the interactions. The other thing that's changed is pesticide companies are now combining pesticides like an insecticide and a fungicide and marketing those things together. And we know from our work in the lab that those things can be synergistic, that they can act together to become more toxic to the bees than either one of those things by themselves. So,
okay.
I mean, a lot of things, and then, of course, we have all these other pressures on the bees, like the mites and like the diseases and the stress from poor nutrition.
Right.
So
they're not having it easy.
No, we exactly right. And we worry about the, basically, you can throw something at an organism, you know, you can throw lots of somethings at an organism until they reach a breaking point. And
right.
That's where we sort of think we are. We're at a breaking point with the bees not being able to handle the stress that's being thrown at them. And one of the major stresses that we think is there are these pesticides. It's clear that we're losing a lot of bees. So, I mean, I don't think it's a lost battle, but I do think that it is, you know, we are at the bees. When I say at a breaking point, I mean that the colonies that are dying from having exposure to all these different stresses, including pesticides, we're losing them, you know, and so they
right.
are, the stresses that we throw at them basically, you know, are breaking the colonies, if you will, or causing the demise of those colonies is what we think, a combination of stresses, of which pesticides is one. So while I like to be optimistic that we will sort of sort this out and bees will bounce back, I do think we're at a critical point in terms
right.
of making some changes to allow that to happen. I mean, I think we're going to potentially see, you know, very expensive fruits and vegetables, very expensive bee-pollinated crops,
mm-hmm.
and that is totally, totally possible. That our food supply, there may be less variety, there may be less diversity, and the things that are there may be more expensive because of what it costs to get the pollination done, and in some cases it might not happen. You know, pollination might not occur if the bees aren't there. We don't know that it's just a pesticide. I mean, we think pesticides are an important part of the story. Absolutely. I mean, that's what our work is all about, and what our evidence so far is that pesticides are playing a role. But, you know, we think there are a lot of other things that are at play, too. And so we're just trying to figure out how big of a piece is the pesticide piece. And that's the goal.
I appreciate your time. Thank you very much.
Sure.
Okay.
You're most welcome.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye. We're joined on the phone now with Dr. May Barenbaum, head of the Department of Entomology at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. Thanks for joining us today, Dr. Barenbaum.
My pleasure.
Now, Dr. Barenbaum, you did see the study, the pesticide study.
I did.
And I did
mm-hmm.
I did tell you that I spoke with Dr. Jeff Pettis last week, and we went over the study. What is it that strikes you as being particularly worrisome about this?
Well, I guess the most alarming aspect of this particular study is the degree to which the hive environment of the honeybee has been contaminated with synthetic materials. The honeybee is an absolutely remarkable species in that it has a very complex social life. It's what's called a eusocial species, and one of the hallmarks of eusocial species is that they control their own environment. They've evolved mechanisms for controlling every aspect of their lives, and evolution hasn't really given them time to develop means of dealing with these synthetic organic insecticides and fungicides and other pesticides.
Right.
Well, in October 2006, the entire genome of the honeybee, you know, the complete set of genetic instructions for the species Apis mellifera, the honeybee, was published. And one of the striking findings of this genome study is that honeybees, relative to other insects, have a reduced inventory of genes that code for enzymes that break down pesticides, the so-called detoxification genes.
Right.
So partly it's assumed that this reduced inventory is associated with their diet of relatively innocuous food. They feed on nectar, which is a plant secretion that's made exclusively to attract pollinators and reward them. So unlike other types of food, like plant foliage that's protected by all kinds of toxic chemicals, nectar is relatively innocuous. Moreover, honeybees have ways of processing nectar and pollen for reducing the content of these plant chemicals. Well, they are genetically not particularly well prepared for the flurry of agrochemicals that are now coming into the hive, not only through their foraging on pollen that contains pesticides that were systemically applied, but also the acaricides or miticides, chemicals that beekeepers use inside the hive to kill this devastating parasite, the varroa mite, that was introduced in the mid-80s.
The EPA is probably well aware of this, right?
Yeah, but in defense of the EPA, honeybees present a really challenging toxicological problem because of their social behavior. Traditionally, the way safety of a pesticide is assessed is by conducting a toxicity test, LD50, the lethal dose that kills 50% of the test organisms.
Right.
But and that's relatively straightforward if you're dealing with caterpillars or dealing with grasshoppers. But if you're dealing with honeybees, a honeybee hive is made out of up of a queen, a couple of hundred drones or males, and 20, 30, 40,000 workers. And the honeybee colony, as such, is like a superorganism. So if you kill off a few workers, the hive responds by producing more workers. So
right.
Exactly what it means to kill a single worker is not clear because you don't really know what the impact is on the hive. Moreover, these are relatively long-lived insects compared to most that have an incredibly sophisticated communication system, so and very advanced behaviors. So again, there's potential for sublethal effects that you
right.
don't see in other insects.
Do you think that the EPA is on the curve with this, or do you think that they're really not paying attention to the intricacies of this particular organism?
Oh, I know that they're aware of these problems. What the solutions are,
right,
is a real puzzle, a major challenge.
Doesn't sound too good for the honeybee right now.
Well, although awareness has been raised I think there's enough concern nationwide that some action will be taken, that the priorities have changed.
Okay, good. That's good. This was a serious study. The results were serious.
Oh, absolutely. The United States, too, for historical reasons, has, at least according to a study, I served on a National Academy of Sciences study to determine the status of pollinators in North America. Among our conclusions was the fact that we really don't know very much about our inventory of pollinators, but
right.
at least for a select few, that it's not just the honeybee that's in trouble, but other species are in trouble. So in the U.S., we have problems with having sufficient numbers of wild pollinators to ensure crop pollination. Thus, we depend disproportionately on our one managed species, one species that we can rear and deliver to a field that's in need of pollination, and that's the honeybee. So we are utterly dependent on this one species of managed pollinator.
And when was this conference, where the National Academy of Sciences, what year was that?
That was a study that was took about 18 months, a year and a half to 2 years.
Okay.
And the report was released, was announced in 2006, October 2006, same month as the genome. And then the publication came out in spring of 2007.
Okay, so it's relatively recent, and they are taking it seriously. Of course, not just for the bees, but they, of course, deserve all the protection that we can give them. But for us, we depend on the bees for pollination. And earlier I asked Jeff Pettis, who, of course, is the head of the Department of Agriculture's Bee Research Laboratory in Beltsville, Maryland, what's the worst-case approach? And he said that if we lose the pollination, we would lose the fruits and vegetables, and we would, of course, depend on those foods that require wind pollination, like corn, rice, and wheat. Our diet would be somewhat more bland. But as a follow-up, he said that we're kind of a spoiled nation, that we do have all of these wide variety of items in our diet. But it did sound like that he was leading me to believe there's a good possibility that we might lose the fruits and vegetables, and we better get used to a more bland diet because we're a little spoiled.
Well, I don't know about losing. I'm not an economist. My guess is that alternative ways of pollinating will be devised, but they will be very pricey. And it's not so much that we will lose these fruits, nuts, and vegetables, which, by the way, I don't consider luxuries at all, and neither does the USDA and its food pyramid guidelines.
But
that they'll be very expensive, and that's already a problem, particularly for low-income families,
mm-hmm.
and where access and availability and price reduce that proportion of their diet that's fruit, nuts, and vegetables to the disadvantage of their health. So I think nationally our health is dependent, the general physical well-being of the American public depends on availability and affordability of fruits, nuts, and vegetables.
Right. Now, Doctor, you are clearly one of the country's recognized leaders in entomology, authorities in entomology, and you have published five books on the subject. Anyone could go to Amazon.com and type in May, that's May, and Berenbaum, Berenbaum, and take a look at these books. Based on all your experience in the field and everything you know, are you optimistic about our approach to this?
I have not been so optimistic in a long time, oddly enough. The 2008 Farm Bill was the first in the history of Farm Bill legislation to mention pollinators. So I think that's a remarkable thing. There is a special funding initiative at the U.S. Department of Agriculture focused on bee health. For decades, we really ignored honeybees, or took them for granted more so than ignored them. And at least now, it's unfortunate it took a crisis to focus attention, but at least now people understand what's at stake. So, I don't know, maybe I should be shouting warning. Well, I guess I'm not sure how to phrase this, but I think there is reason for hope. And I have I think we have people in the honeybee community generally acknowledge that we've made more progress in understanding honeybees in the context of agriculture in the last 2 years than in the past 20 years.
Wow. And it seems like it's just in the nick of time.
Well, I hope so.
Well, Dr. Berenbaum, I want to thank you so much for taking the time out of your busy schedule to speak with us. Thank you very
much. Well, thank you for your interest and help the bees.
Thank you very much.
Thanks.
Take care.
You too.